All right, let's start with our kids' time. Any kids that want to come up, we're going to start out with a game. So if you're interested, come on forward. Dan, you're like 2 years over. 2 years over the limit. Yeah, Connor, you can come on. Come on over here. Come on over, kids. Come on. What's up? How we doing? How we doing? You having a good morning? Eli, good to see you. Hi, sweetie. How are you? Good to see you. All right, you guys ready to play a game? We're going to play a fun game. Okay, so here's the game. We're all going to stay kind of in this area, all right? So don't go anywhere else. All right, here's the deal. Here's the rule. If I poke you, you have to poke me back, okay? Can you guys do that? Do you think you can do that? You think you can poke me? Yeah, even you, Connor, even you. Don't hurt me, all right? So, all right, so here's the rule, all right? Now, as soon as I call timeout, game's over, okay? We're not going to run anywhere. We're just going to stay right here, okay? You guys ready? You guys ready? Now, you're not poking each other, just poking me. So, you guys ready? You guys ready?
Yeah.
You ready? You ready, Kensley? All right, here we go. All right, time out. Okay, now go ahead and sit down. We're going to talk about what just happened. So, that was a fun game, right? That was a fun game. Now, can you imagine if it was a little bit different instead of being a fun game? What if it actually hurt? What if it was actually like a hit? That'd be hard, right? So if I hit you and you hit me, how many times did I get poked? I got poked a lot, didn't I? All of you guys were poking me. I got poked a lot. Well, what if you felt like every time you got hit or you got hurt, you felt like you had to hurt somebody back? Man. That's what you do to your sister? All right, we'll talk to your mommy about that. Just kidding. Yeah, it's easy, right? That's the way you feel. If someone hurts you, if someone does something wrong to you, that's what you feel like doing, right? It's called retaliation. It's a big word for some of you, but sometimes we feel like being mean to somebody when they're mean to us. But does that really work?
No,
it doesn't work. It doesn't work because... Yeah, we'd start fighting with each other, right? And we would never stop. If every time I hurt somebody and they hurt me back, and then I had to hurt them, it would never stop. It'd be a cycle that would go on forever. So if someone hurts us, what do we do?
Hurt them back.
Hurt them back? That's a good idea. But no, we're not going to hurt them back. We're actually going to tell somebody. Who are we going to tell? Who would be somebody that we want to tell if someone hurts us? Mom and dad. Or another adult that you trust, right? Right? So, hey, kids, I want you to hear this from me. If anyone is hurting you, if anyone's really hurting you seriously, you can come talk to me, okay? And we'll make sure that you're safe. All right? But if someone's hurting you, if someone's being mean to you, we don't hit them back. We don't be mean to them back. We want to be loving like Jesus was loving to us and be loving back to him.
My sister gets on me.
Yeah. When she does that, you want to be loving to her. And that's what we want to do. All right, thanks, kids. Head on back to your seats. How perfect was that? That was great. Yeah, I live for moments like that. That was awesome. All right, shifting gears. Last week, we woke up to some bad news. We woke up to some tragic news. El Paso and Dayton, they were both reeling from the tragedies that were there. And I'm sure that you've heard all the chatter from the politicians and media personalities and your friends and your wild relatives on social media. They all have their ideas and their things that they're focusing on, and I'm sure you've heard, man, it's the guns that are a problem, it's the public policy that's the problem, it's the video games, it's mental health, like there's all sorts of different things that can be blamed and are a part of that, and that's an important conversation to have about what is causing these tragedies, what's behind it, and I want to have that conversation, but not here, not now. What I want to focus on and what I want us to not lose sight on is the central fact. the central pieces to the tragic stuff that's happening right now. And that is this: we live in the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. And something is terribly, terribly wrong if these things are happening. Something is really, really, really wrong when these things are happening. I just got an update, a little news update. There was an attack on a mosque in Norway, and a gunman shot through the door. And thankfully, there's a positive end to this. A 75-year-old man inside subdued the guy, got the gun out of his way, chokehold the guy, and then sat on him until police came. So thankfully, yeah, like Rose is like, yes, yeah, do it, right? That's awesome. 75-year-old man pulled that off. But to think of the hate that that guy had to walk into a mosque. Let me be very clear, by the way. Please do not hate people. Please do not hate people of other races, of other ethnicities, of other religions, of other political. Like, that has no place in this world. And yet, that's what we find. Something is terribly wrong. We can all agree there's many factors, but at the center is hate. Hate killed. And so, how ought we respond to hate? What are we supposed to do to that? What are we supposed to do when we live in this world that's filled with hate? Well, the civil rights movement utilized the principle of nonviolence to transform our nation. You look back at the history and what they did with the nonviolence, it led to the transformation in our nation. Now, how did it transform us? Well, the voluntary choice of non-resistance and the self-control to act it out are actually actions, and in fact, powerful actions. And today we're going to see why that's the case. To have non-resistance and have self-control, not to retaliate, is actually a powerful action that pays dividends. So to demonstrate that these are actually actions that you have to put work into, imagine with me, go with me in your mind, pretend that you are back in the 1960s and you are protesting at a restaurant that is segregated. You may, in your mind, imagine yourself as an African American. You may view yourself and imagine yourself as a Caucasian or a Hispanic, but you are there protesting the fact that the restaurant is segregated. They were called sit-ins. And so while you're there, imagine what those people that were against you, against the protest, would be yelling in your ear. Imagine the obscenities, the cruelty, the hate that they would be spewing at you this far away from your face, threatening violence upon your family, calling you all sorts of names. Imagine what that would feel like. Now, imagine the restraint that it would take to not retaliate. It's an effort. It takes an effort in the face of criticism like that, in the face of attacks like that, in the face of hate, not to return hate for hate. It is an incredibly powerful action. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi both used this principle of nonviolence here in America and in India, respectively, and both found their source for this nonviolent principle in the Bible itself, and in fact, the passage that we're covering today. This is where they're getting it from. This is where it's coming from. The five verses we're going to cover today and then the six that we're going to cover next week have brought about justice for millions of people just in these 11 verses. The Sermon on the Mount is revolutionary, and we're approaching some of its most revolutionary statements that it makes in the entire sermon. All right, so we are in the fifth of the six in the series where he says, "You have heard it said, but I say to you," this is the fifth of six. We're going to cover the next one next week, and then we're going to take two sermons, and we're going to really dive in with what we've just talked about. We've hit each section individually. Now we're going to take the totality of it, and first, I'm going to answer, then what does it mean that someone is good? What does that mean when we say someone is good? That's going to be the first sermon. And then the second sermon is, how do we take this section and actually use it evangelistically? Because it is possibly some of the most powerful evangelistic tools that you can use are these verses here. So I want to teach you how to use them. All right, so here we are. We're in Matthew chapter 5. We're going to be in verses 38 through 42. I'll allow you to get there in your Bibles if you haven't gotten there already. We're going to start verses 38 and 39 here. First part of 39. So here's what Jesus said. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. Let's start here. All right, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that's going to be conflicted with or compared with to some degree. Do not resist an evil person. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that's probably pretty familiar to you. It comes up several places in the Old Testament and was meant for the law to establish, all right, if you commit a crime, here is your equal punishment that you would receive because you committed this crime. Pretty simple. If I go and I harm somebody and I knock out their eye, my punishment by law would be my eye gets taken out. Same for tooth, all of that. So that's where it's coming from. It's coming straight out of the law. Now, the first thing to note that's very important is the context here. This is a commandment for the government, the establishment, the government of Israel. This is the law that they're to enforce. Is that this is not a commandment for individuals. This is not condoning Batman vigilante. All right, you did this, now I'm going to go. No, this is for the government to enforce this law. So an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth is talking to the government, not individuals. So then it goes on, back in verse 39. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. How many of you have thought before, these are tough? These are tough passages. These are tough commandments to keep. Anyone ever felt that before? Oh, yeah. A few of you? I have, for sure. I'm looking at that going, man. They slap me on the right cheek. I got to turn my... All right, so they're tough. They seem tough. It's because they are tough. But they're even worse when you understand the Old Testament or the ancient world context that this is coming in. They're actually even harder than it is when you read it in English. There's some stuff in here that you look at the background and it's actually a little rougher than it seems. So let's take each one in turn here. All right, so slaps you on the right cheek. Now, think through. Someone slaps you, they don't slap you from behind, so they're slapping you from in front. If they're slapping you on the right side, most people are right-handed, what does that mean? They're not slapping you with the left. This is a backhanded slap. It's not just someone slaps you, it's someone insults you. This is like climax, you know, the height of insults back in the day. So if you wanted to really insult somebody, backhand slap to the face. So he's saying to them, hey, if someone doesn't just slap you, they slap you on the right cheek, they are insulting you. All right, so that's not easy. Yeah, you just turn your other cheek to that. All right, so that's that one. Let's go to the next one. If someone sues your shirt, give up your coat. Okay, this coat that they're talking about was this really heavy, long coat. You could describe it as coat, but it was also, you would use it as your sheets, your bed sheets. You'd use it when it's cold outside, you'd use that to be your bed and you would sleep. If you're like traveling or whatever, that would be like your bed sheets. It'd be like your comforter. That's how big this thing was. Here's how they described it. If you didn't have this shirt and this coat that you're talking about, so you have the undershirt and then you have this coat over it. He's saying if someone sues you for your shirt, you give them your coat also. Here's how they described it if you didn't have a coat. You were essentially naked in their opinion. You were basically walking around naked in their opinion. They probably had undergarments, but culturally, it'd be like us walking around in our underwear out in public. And Jesus is saying, hey, if they sue you for your shirt, Give them your code also. If you're not wealthy, if you don't have a number of these, that's what you're doing. You're saying, all right, I'm going to have to find another way to not be naked in public. That's a big one. All right, the next one. Go the extra mile. This one cracks me up, right? Because you hear this in like customer service. We want to go the extra mile. That's what we want to be. They're not using it right at all. Like that's not at all the context for go the extra mile. We want to go the extra mile for our customer. Well, okay, but it's totally different than what this is talking about. Here's what this is talking about. This is talking about, it says if someone forces you to go, here's who would force you to go a mile. It would be a Roman soldier. It would be a Roman soldier who had legal authority to conscript you to take all of their military baggage with them. And they were allowed to have you go 1 mile with it. So here comes a Roman soldier. He says, hey, Steve, you're going to be carrying my baggage, and you have to. You're carrying their sword. You're carrying their weapons. You're carrying all this different stuff. This is the, this is the oppressive nation having you carry their stuff for them. This isn't just, hey, if someone forces you to walk 1 mile. This is if someone forces you, who is your oppressor, who is in control of your country, if he says, carry all my baggage, you're to go the mile, and then you're to go an extra mile. All right, last one. Hey, if someone asks you for money, to borrow money, you give it. They didn't have a lot of money back in the day, folks. They didn't have a ton of money like we have. So if you're giving money out, this is difficult. All right, so this is really, really tough stuff that Jesus is saying, hey, you need to do these things. Really, really hard back in the day for them to do that. So if you receive a backhanded slap, you offer the other cheek. If a Roman soldier conscripts you, you carry his weapons a mile, and you go an extra mile. That means if you are physically assaulted, if your honor is attacked, your belongings are taken, your time and freedom are conscripted, your money requested, what do? You do not resist the evil one. So says Jesus. Yikes. Notice that the person is evil. This is an evil person. It's not like, hey, if someone is just in a bad way and they're kind of a nice person, but they just had a little bit of bad luck and they're starting to treat people bad, then you go and do this. No, this is someone that is purely evil. That's who you're supposed to do this to. All right, this is getting worse. So you find yourself oppressed by an evil person. What are your options? What could you do? Well, what's the most natural? Retaliate, right? Retaliation, that's your most natural option. They do something to me, I do something back to them. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that sounds good to me. But that's for the government. Remember, that's not for individuals. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to take vengeance personally back into your own hands. That's not God's design. So he says we're to refrain from the cycle of retaliation. Don't return evil for evil. But it's not just that. All right, so let's pause there and think, okay? It's hard enough someone insults you, backhanded insult, for you not to retaliate back with another insult. That's hard enough, right? Yeah, that's hard enough. It's hard enough not to go there. But Jesus goes beyond that. You don't just refrain from retaliating. You go further and voluntarily offer something extra. Ah, yikes. It's the other cheek. It's the coat as well, the extra mile, an open hand giving and borrowing. So take a moment and think about what Jesus was telling these Jews to do. You are in God's promised land, and you have been taken over by a pagan Gentile nation filled with wicked, evil people. And they will conscript you and say, you have to take my military equipment that is part of your oppression a mile. And Jesus says, you got to take it another mile voluntarily. That's pretty hard. So, why on earth would Jesus command this? What is he doing? This stuff is crazy talk. Why is he commanding these things? Well, first, let's make sure we're clear on what this is and what this is not. All right, let's be clear on what he's saying and what he's not saying, because if we get off, man, there's some really bad interpretations that come out of this. So if you read it in English, it sounds a certain way, and you can miss some stuff, so you got to be careful here. These bad interpretations cause some really bad consequences. So we're going to start out by making sure we know what this is saying and what it's not saying. So first question, does this mean that there should not be any governments that do judgment? Should we be in anarchy? Is that what it's saying? No, it's not saying that. It's not talking about that. Right? That would contradict the Old Testament, and it contradicts other stuff that's in the New Testament, including Romans 13. It's talking about individuals turning the other cheek, not governments. All right? So it's not talking about that. Corollary question that you often get, does this mean that there's no such thing as a just war? There's no such thing as a time where a country should go to war with another? No, it's not talking about that, right? The command to turn the other cheek and all of that is for individuals, not governments. So it's not talking about that. Let's start there. It's talking to individuals. Okay, does this mean then, if you as an individual, if you are attacked, that you don't defend yourself? Is that what it's talking about? If you're being attacked, and are you supposed to, in turning the other cheek, does that mean you do not defend yourself? No, it doesn't mean that at all. The offense has already occurred. Think about what he said. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, it's already happened. If they force you to go an extra mile, if they sue to get your shirt, right? The offense has already occurred. So it's not like the offense is oncoming. It's not talking about that. It's not talking about not defending yourself. What it's talking about is the response to the offense. See the difference? What is your response to the offense that has already happened? All right. Here's some examples of Jesus and Paul actually doing this very thing, defending themselves. Jesus is in John 10. He's about to be stoned. What does he do? Does he just go limp? Does he just say, "Oh, I'm not gonna defend myself"? No, he questions them and challenges them and says, "For which of my deeds are you stoning me?" He calls them on it. He challenges them. Jesus, the one who said the same thing here, he challenges them on it. We see this in Paul numerous times. This happens a lot, right? So in Acts 22, the Jews have turned on Paul and they hand him over to the Roman authorities and they say, "Hey, do with him what you want," and they're about to flog him. And so what does Paul do? Does he say, "I need to turn the other cheek," meaning I'm going to stay silent, I'm not going to do anything, and I'm not supposed to defend myself with the truth? No, what does he do? He says, "You're not going to flog a Roman citizen without a trial, are you?" That was against the law. They didn't realize he was a Roman citizen. He defends himself. These aren't in contradictions. All right, so it's not talking about not defending yourself. When we hear the word resist in English, it can connote, it can bring to mind this idea there's an ongoing attack and we're resisting the ongoing attack. That's what pops into my mind anyways. But that's not what's happening as you look at the context in the original language. We can have great harm come when we misunderstand this. Literally, there have been people that have read this passage, and then when abuse or assault is coming, they think to themselves, "I have to not resist, defend myself from this," even though everything in their soul says that's wrong. They've misinterpreted this passage. That has happened to great calamity for these people. So, hear me clearly. If you're abused or you're assaulted, this passage does not mean you do not defend yourself. It's not talking about that. Let me also be clear. This does not mean that you do not call the authorities if you've been assaulted. It does not mean that. All right? If you're being abused, feel free to defend yourself. If you have been assaulted, please call the authorities. That is consistent with what is being taught here. I'm going to show you what it's really saying. Not those things. It's not talking about those things. So if it's not saying that, what is it saying? It's talking about your reaction after the attack has come. You have a choice about how to respond after the fact. So here's the specific scenarios that fit the context. Two things. Number one, the victim has already been victimized. The offense has already happened. Number one. Number two, the victim is free and able and capable to respond. If you don't have those two scenarios, this isn't talking about it. This doesn't apply to those scenarios. So you have to have both. The offense has already happened, and you are free and capable and able to act after the fact. So, here, for instance, there have been people that have claimed that this passage tells girls if they're going to be, let's say, assaulted, I'm using that word for the adults, think about it. If they're about to be assaulted, they're supposed to just let it happen. Not what it's talking about. Why? Because both criteria of what I just said haven't been met. The assault hasn't happened yet. And even after it happens, they're not free or capable to act after that in the ways that you would normally think you're free and capable. It doesn't fit what he's talking about. So don't get this weird idea that, hey, you're not, if a girl's about to be assaulted, you don't do anything. All right. So if you are in a place to react after an offense, what do you do? Number one, you don't retaliate, but in fact, you bless. You return blessing. So you do not retaliate, you offer blessing. That's how you're supposed to respond. These responses that Jesus is talking about, turning the other cheek, all that, they are acts of defiance. That's what they really are. To turn the other cheek is an act of defiance. You sue me, I give you my coat. You slap me, I offer the other cheek. What this communicates is that you are above the offense. The offense isn't over you. It doesn't have control over you. That's one of the reasons why assault is not in this category. It's in a different category. But when you act in this way, you are saying, I am above the offense that you have done. I have risen above the hate that you have presented. If you return hate for hate, the hate is in control. But if you have hate come your way and you bring blessing, you're in control of the hate. You're in control of yourself. You have overcome the offense. You have become the master. And this is the point of the Sermon on the Mount. This is it. Rise above what is natural. That's what the point is. The kingdom hasn't come because Israel has been enslaved by their passions. They've been enslaved by their sin. They've fallen to that. They can't get out of it. And because of that, the kingdom hasn't come. And so if the kingdom is going to come, they have to be above their natural willingness and desire to sin. They have to achieve above that. They have to rise above. They have to become masters of their flesh. You don't magically have the kingdom come while you're still drowning in an ocean of sin. It's not going to happen. So he's going to come and say, you have to rise above that ocean of death to be worthy of the kingdom that God offers. Hate and those caught under hate are not going to bring the kingdom. Why? Because they keep getting caught in this cycle of retaliation. And pain is given for pain. That's not God's order. Instead, what Jesus calls us to is to rise above our passions, restrain ourselves from retaliation, and offer blessing. And let me explain why that's the case. Why do we so easily move to hate? Think about that for a minute. When someone hates you, when someone does something against you, why is it so easy for you to go to hate? Because you've been harmed. That's an injustice, right? You've been harmed. You've experienced injustice. You're in the middle of that. And so when you experience that injustice, what happens? You panic. There's a feeling of panic that's there. Why? It's like that panic that you get when you're starving, right? When you're really hungry, and your body is like terrified that it's not going to get food anymore. goes into a panic. You have something that you need that you don't have, or you're thirsty, right? Your body panics. Well, you need justice. And so when you're in injustice, you feel like you're starving. And so you have this panic feel. And how do you fix that? What's the immediate thought of how to fix that? The immediate thought is, I'm going to retaliate. I'm going to bring about justice. I'm going to hurt them the way that they hurt me. I'm going to make the justice. But that panic and that retaliation does not bring justice. It just brings more retaliation. When you get slapped, that panic makes you want to slap in return. That's what it does. What Jesus is pointing to is that if we're viewing God properly, you don't need to panic. If you really view God correctly, you don't need to panic when you've been harmed. Let's talk about why that is. That's not to say, by the way, that you're not supposed to cry for justice. We see this in Revelation 6. The martyrs who've been beheaded, they cry out to God, when will we be justified? When will you bring about our vengeance? And then you see this also with David. He's repeatedly throughout the Psalms, he's crying out for justice. So it's not that you don't cry out for justice, but their cries come from a place of assurance, not panic. In both of those cases, they have placed their hope of justice in the hands of God, not in their own. You see the difference? They trust God will bring them justice. They're not panicked that they're not going to get it. So, if God has promised you justice, you don't need to go gain it yourself. It's assured. It's coming. He's promised it. You're going to be justified. Justice will come your way. You don't need to retaliate. But it doesn't stop there. You don't need to not retaliate. It goes farther than that. Waiting for justice is proper, it's good, but it alone does not bring you to godliness. We must be like him. And here's where he goes with it. God offers mercy over judgment. He offers grace. And he's calling us to do the same thing. When wronged, we must do likewise. This is our act of defiance. When faced with an evil person and their oppression that they bring upon us, the godly respond with grace. You can borrow this. I'll go another mile. That's defiance. That's defiant of what they're doing. I resist your wickedness, and I refuse to bow to your hate. I defy your hate by bringing and offering love and mercy. And why can we do that? Because our justice is assured and our focus is higher than ourselves. That's why. We trust God to take care of, provide for, and protect us. We trust that. We're going to receive justice. Furthermore, we trust in heaven over this life. When you're focused on this life, then gaining justice now causes panic. You're going to panic when you're in that state. But when you look higher, you gain God's perspective. And what's the higher perspective that God has and that he wants us to have? Here's the higher perspective. Your oppressor is not your enemy. They're not your enemy. Your enemy is spiritual, not a person. At least not a human. People, we're broken, we're ignorant, we're blind, and the reality is we panic. And when we panic, we act in stupid ways. God's mission from the beginning has been to save us from that delusion that we're not going to get what we need. He wants to save the lost from that. So we don't have to panic when all of that arises. And he's calling us to do the same, to have the same mission. The higher perspective cares for the offender. Here are three ways that when you turn the other cheek or go the extra mile, you're actually blessing the oppressor. Think about what this is, all right? Think about these three ways. Number one, it actually gives them something. It gives them an extra mile. It gives them the coat. You're literally giving them something that's a blessing. Number two, it enlightens them to the higher lifestyle. You are literally showing them that it's possible that they don't have to live in the panic anymore. They're caught up in the cycle of retaliation, and that's all they know because that's all they see. You heard me, I heard you. That's all they've seen. If you don't do that, if you rise above that, you are demonstrating that it's possible that there's a whole other way to live where you don't have to retaliate. You don't have to live in the panic. You can be assured and be in control of yourself. You can be master. That's what you're showing them. And number three, third thing you're doing, it shines a spotlight on their panic and their hate. Ooh. That's actually a good thing. That's a painful thing for them to feel, but that's a blessing that you can give to them. Here's what Proverbs 25 says, verse 21 and 22. If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. And if he's thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Burning coals on his head? Man, burning coals on his head. You just gave him food and drink. Why is that like pouring burning coals on someone's head? Because it exposed their wickedness. That's why. It exposes their wickedness. When you retaliate, you're oppressed. What happens? They hurt you and you retaliate. What are they paying attention to? The pain that you caused them. They're not paying attention to themselves. They're not even thinking about what they're taking that as an excuse to look at you rather than themselves. What happens when you bless somebody after they hurt you? There's nowhere else to look. They can't blame you for being nice to them. They can't go, oh man, he did something nice for me. All that's left then is to look at their own wickedness and their own shortcomings. You are shining a spotlight on the reason that they are wicked and wrong. And that is like staring at fire. Why? Because it's judgment. It is a positive thing in the right context to show somebody judgment is coming. That's actually giving them blessing. So when you act this way, when you turn the other cheek, you're doing three things that's bringing blessing to them. Number one, you're giving them something extra. Number two, it's enlightening them that they don't have to live in panic. And number three, it's shining a spotlight on their wickedness and their panic. We see something similar with Dr. King's strategy, Martin Luther King Jr. He spelled out the goal that he had of nonviolent resistance in his letter from Birmingham Jail in 1963. Listen to what it says. Quote, nonviolent direct action, and just stop right there for a second. Listen to how he described what they were doing. Nonviolent direct action. In his mind, what they were doing was, it was passive, but very, very active at the same time. It's a direct action. All right, so that's awesome. Let's go back. Quote, nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It creates a crisis and causes such a tension that the community must confront it. That's awesome. That's awesome. We're going to make it so uncomfortable in here that you have to do something about this. Guess what? When you give blessing after receiving a curse, it causes such a tension and a conflict within them that they have to confront what their sin is. They have to look Jesus in the face, and they have to either accept him or reject him. That's what turning the other cheek does. That's giving a blessing. That's giving them something that they need. They need to see God. But in that place where they look God in the face, God offers them mercy. There's mercy. You can get out of the panic as well. And pause right there. The godly want their enemies to receive mercy. And that's the point. The godly want their enemies to receive mercy. That's what the people of God are like. Because that's what God's like. So if we're at a place and we want to see our enemies, get it, yeah, give it to them. That's not what God wants. It's going to happen. Justice will be there, but that's not what we want. What we want is for our enemies to receive mercy. Folks, we naturally want judgment. That's where our nature takes us. And in turn, we naturally want to retaliate. But that keeps our world spinning in chaos. To exit that cycle, mercy must triumph over judgment in our hearts, in our decisions, and in our actions. And why would we dare bow to such a humble state as that? To bring blessing and mercy to our enemies. Because we are sons of the Father. That's why. A little later on, Jesus is going to be slapped. He's going to be mocked. He's going to be humiliated. He's going to be flogged. He's going to be hung. Did he retaliate? No, he did not resist the evil ones. And in fact, he prayed for their forgiveness. If you're in this church and you say you follow Jesus, that's what it means. You don't resist the evil one. You give mercy instead. You pray for their forgiveness. This will cost us, folks. It's going to hurt. But at the end of the line, you get to be like God. You get to live with God. And you get to spread his mercy. So will you seek mercy for those who oppress you? Will you bless those that curse you? Will you love your enemies? Jesus did for you, and he did for me. And with that, let me pray, and let's go to the Lord's table. And remember that we are the ones that slapped him. We are the ones that mocked him. We are the ones that brought about the need for him to die on the cross. Please join me in prayer. Lord, there's just no way that we're going to be able to accomplish what you've called us to do on our own. There's no way that we're going to be able to turn the other cheek, to walk the extra mile, to do all of that, unless you are creating in us your spirit to be able to accomplish what you have called us to do. We're broken, we're incapable, we can't do this on our own. And we pray, Lord, that you would have us have the mercy and the perspective of loving our enemies the way that you loved us. Lord, I know that many of us have been harmed and will be harmed and will be hurt and will be assaulted. And in that time, Lord, I pray that you would bring comfort and peace, but also strength and defiance to not give in to the hate, but instead to bring about your love. And in so doing, Lord, I pray that your kingdom would expand. Help us to want mercy for our oppressors and our enemies. And help us to want them to come to you. And as they do, Lord, offer them mercy the same way that you did to us. We thank you, God, for your salvation that you offer to us. And we come to your table now in confidence and in boldness, knowing what you paid to make it happen. We thank you, Lord. In your name, amen.